troubled psychologist was a woman in her 40s, with flowing clothes, a long purple skirt, a shawl wrapped around her shoulders, and clumpy clog-like shoes. Though her appearance wasn't particularly professional, she did have a comforting presence, like everyone's favourite auntie. She spoke clearly and gently.
Hello, Aidan. My name's Cathy, and I'm here to ask you a few questions and see how you're doing. Is that all right?
Aidan remained silent.
Did Dr. Schaefer warn you about Aidan's present state? I asked.
Cathy, who had introduced herself to me as Dr. Foster, nodded and smiled.
He did. That's okay. We'll take our time with Aidan.
She turned back to him. I'd bought Aidan some new clothes that morning, so he was wearing a pair of jeans with a plain blue jumper. I had wanted to buy him something trendy, something a normal teenager would like, but I didn't know what a 16-year-old boy would want to wear. When I was 16, I wore nothing but black. My dad would balk at the length of my skirt or the coating of eyeliner around my eyes, and Mum would just roll her eyes. Somehow, I didn't think Aidan was interested in rebelling against me just yet. Aidan sat quietly at a little table in the corner of his hospital room. Dr. Foster joined him at the table, sitting opposite him. The psychologist reached into her bag and removed a notepad and pen.
"Would you like to write or draw anything, Aidan?"
I watched eagerly as Dr. Foster pushed the notepad and pen across the table. I rubbed one hand with the other, hoping and wishing he would lift the pen. If he could communicate with us in even the smallest way, that would be something. It would be wonderful. Aidan stared down at the notepad but didn't make any move to pick up the pen. I chewed on my bottom lip while Rob stood on my right side and Jake hovered on my left. DCI Stevenson had left us in the care of two family liaison officers while he went back to the police station to work on the case. They were waiting in the corridor to give us some space. Denise and Marcus, they were called. Dr. Schaefer was doing his rounds on the ward. As much as it felt like Aidan was the only child in the world, he wasn't. He wasn't even the only child in the world who had been through the same suffering.
"Perhaps you could draw us a nice picture," Dr. Foster went on. "Doesn't matter what it is. Anything that pops into your mind."
Aidan's gaze never moved from the pen and paper, and in my mind I imagined that he really wanted to take the pen. I rubbed my hands again, hoping and praying he would. He leaned forward and I leaned with him, almost stepping towards them. But I didn't. I hung back, giving them space. It must have been off-putting having us all watching him like that, but there was no way I was letting the psychologist in the room without me there. Then, in one quick, fluid moment, Aidan snatched up the pen and pulled the notebook towards him. I let out a breath, only then aware that I'd been holding it. Dr. Foster glanced up at me with a small, hopeful smile on her face. What if Aidan could write? He'd been proficient for a 6-year-old before he was snatched, but I had no idea what he'd been taught or not taught since then. Did he have books where he'd been? Had he kept a diary of his world? I screwed my eyes shut and opened them again. Aidan was drawing in the notepad. He was drawing something. I turned to Rob and then to Jake, my chest heaving up and down. This was good, it had to be. This was a step in the right direction. Finally. And after this, how long would it be before he started talking again? Then he'd be able to tell us what had happened to him. We'd find his kidnapper and throw him in jail. Unless I murdered him first. If it weren't for prison. I shook my head, forcing the dark thoughts away. Though one question remained. Could I? While Aidan scribbled on the notebook, I resisted the urge to step closer and lean over his shoulder. Aidan deserved a moment to express himself. There was a terrible tale inside him that one day he would need to tell the world. Let him breathe, I thought to myself. Slowly, Aidan's hand came to a stop. I wasn't close enough to see what he had drawn, but I knew he had been scribbling rather quickly, veering his fist from one side of the page to the other as he worked the pen.
That's wonderful, Aidan, said Dr. Foster as Aidan pushed the book back to her. And what is that a drawing of? Is it the place where you were when you were away? My heart skipped a beat. But Aidan's face gave nothing away. He was as blank and calm as always. "Shall we show this to your mum?" Dr. Foster asked.
He didn't reply, of course, but I stepped towards the table anyway, with a face as pale as milk. Dr. Foster lifted the sheet of paper.
It was filled with one untidy black scribble with ferocious pen strokes that almost completely filled the page. Chapter 11. I could have kicked myself for not thinking to give Aidan a pen and some paper before the psychologist saw him. Aidan was always a visual child. He hated colouring books as a boy, preferring to scribble or paint on blank sheets of paper. I bought him his first watercolour set when he was 4. Bishop Town on Ouse was an abundance of spots perfect for young mothers and their sons to explore, armed only with a painting set. We found a huge oak tree which turned into the headquarters for a badly behaved fairy king. Aidan painted orange and red leaves on a thick brown trunk. The ooze was the perfect spot for a tsunami, so I drew little surfers on top of his blue waves. Aidan loved to paint with colours. He copied pictures from his favourite comic books, creating his own messy versions of Superman and Spider-Man. He'd grown up with a set of parents who loved art and loved to paint and draw. And of course, he needed that outlet now. But the picture I saw in that hospital room was not Aidan. It was spiky and harsh. It was painful to look at. Dr. Foster gave me the sheet of paper to keep, and as we were driving home from the hospital, I took the paper out and stared at it, following the lines with my finger. There were no recognizable shapes within his drawing. There was nothing that could be used in the investigation. Aidan had not drawn us the pretty picture of his prison, nor had he drawn us a map of where he had emerged from the woods. There was nothing except pain and anger in his work, and I didn't need to be any kind of therapist to see that. But I did feel that it was worth Dr. Foster visiting him again. So we arranged some dates for over the next few weeks. She managed to fit Aidan in as a priority around her other clients, and I was grateful for that. The next day, Dr. Schaefer informed me that there was little reason to keep Aidan in the hospital. Aside from the old injury on his ankle, there was nothing seriously wrong with him, at least physically. His growth had been somewhat stunted, but otherwise he was healthy. I would be taking him home tomorrow. That Saturday disappeared in a blur as I rushed back to the house, made up the bed in the spare room, and placed the one stuffed toy I'd allowed myself to keep after I declared my son dead. It was a small, soft dragon with red scales that shimmered when the light hit them. My mum had given it to Aidan when he was a baby, representing her Welsh ancestry. I placed it on the pillow and folded the bedding around it to make it look like it had been tucked in. It was silly, but I used to do that when he was a toddler. Then I took the clothes from the shopping bags around the room and folded them into the drawers. Poor Jake had given me his credit card to use, and I had gone a little wild, trying to somehow make up for Aidan's 10 years of hell with expensive jeans. At one point I dug out a couple of pieces of his artwork and tacked them to the wall. Then I thought better of it and pulled them down again. Aidan wasn't a little boy anymore. The dragon, though, that had to stay. He had never slept without it when he was little. He needed to know I remembered. The next morning I woke with butterflies in my stomach at the thought of bringing my son home. With it being a Sunday, Jake was off from work, of course. But I suggested he give Aidan and me the day to settle in. He agreed, eager to do what was best for Aidan, and I think a little guilty about the way he'd reacted at the hospital. Rob picked me up to take me to the hospital, driving his dad's car. We decided that it would be too much for Sonia and Peter to be there. We wanted to keep this simple and quiet. There was the threat of the press looming above us. They would find out soon, we were certain of that, but how much and when? That axe was yet to fall. "Are you ready?" Rob asked, as I pulled the seatbelt across my body. "Are you?" I replied. He rolled up the sleeves of his shirt, and I noticed the hint of a tattoo peeking out from underneath the sleeve. It was black, with a slight tail looping down. "A dragon?" I asked. "Like Aidan's," he replied. "I found it and put it on his bed." "He never slept without it," Rob said. "I know." I pressed my finger into the corner of my eye and tried hard to stop the tears building up. "No, I'm not ready for this. But I won't let it show. I won't." "It's all right, Em. You're doing a good job. Fuck, you're doing better than I am. And you have the..." He glanced at my belly. "The baby is fine. She's not the elephant in the room. You can mention her." "She? So Aidan will have a little sister. That's great. I'll be great for him." "I hope so." Rob was quiet for the rest of the journey, and I couldn't help but wonder what was going through his mind. after a few minutes I gave up and thought of Aidan. There was a nervous tickling in my stomach as we pulled into the hospital car park. It was early October and the leaves of the old sycamore trees on the edge of the paved area were turning amber and gold. Low-hanging mist obscured the autumn colours and blurred through the parked cars. The windscreen wipers squeaked across the glass, smearing fine rain into milky streaks. "So what's he like?" Rob asked, as he unclipped his seatbelt. Gave him a look as if to say who. With Aidan in hospital, I spent a fair bit of time with Rob, and I was already allowing myself to relax. I remembered giving Rob that look 100 times when we were together. He'd always tested my patience, but at one time that had felt like a good thing, an exciting thing. "Hewitt." "Supportive," I said. "Reliable. Good husband. He'll be a great dad." "Better than me, then." "Oh, for God's sake," I said in a raspy voice, struggling with the door to the Ford. "Does it matter? Fucking grow up, Rob. You weren't there. I moved on. I'm happy, all right? What's done is done, and it doesn't matter anyway. None of it does. Aidan is all that matters now." I let go of the door handle and sighed. "So, can you deal with this? Can you work through your pathetic issues and be a man, be a dad? Because if you can't, then turn around and drive out of this car park right now and never come back into Aidan's life. He needs stability. He needs love. It's not an either-or situation here. I need you to give him both." Rob held his hands up in surrender. All right, I know. Okay? I know he needs that from me. I'm going to be there for you both, I promise." His words freed a part of me, lifting a suffocating weight from my chest. Who knew what I needed most was the reassurance that he'd help. I guess I'd been carrying too much on my own to breathe. Outside the car, the air was full of drizzle, with a strong breeze rustling the auburn leaves. Though it was a small hospital in an affluent area, St. Michael still had that faded hospital look, with a dirty beige painted exterior and steps grimy with moss leading to the entrance. I pulled my woolen cardigan closer to my throat to stem the chill. We walked the familiar steps towards the ward and exchanged pleasantries with Dr. Schaefer. The family liaison officers were already there. PC Denise Ellis was a short but sturdy woman of Afro-Caribbean descent. PC Marcus Hawthorne was tall, lanky and pasty-faced with limp red hair. Though I preferred DCI Stevenson to keep us updated, the two of them seemed mild-mannered and professional, never raising their voices and always offering us cups of tea and coffee. We walked into Aidan's room to find him standing at the window staring out. He was dressed in jeans and a striped jumper that I'd dropped off at the hospital. He hadn't had his hair cut, so it was still straggly and touched the top of his shoulders. His eyes were slightly red-rimmed, though I doubted it was from crying. More likely he'd had a bad night's sleep. I hoped he didn't have any nightmares, but I was almost sure he did. "Are you all set?" I asked again with a bright, cheery voice that sounded forced. I kept reminding myself of annoying TV presenters on the kids' channels, bright-eyed and blonde with a permanent grin fixed to their faces. Aidan moved away from the window and towards me, but again he didn't say a word. He didn't really look at me either, but at least he was walking towards me. That was a start. It was an acknowledgement of my presence. It was better than nothing. "Right then, pal," Rob said. "Better say your goodbyes to Dr. Schaefer and the others. We're taking you home, mate. Mum's got Walnut the Dragon all ready for you." I'd almost forgotten that bit. Aidan insisted on calling his dragon Walnut because my mum loved her walnut whips, and I was always teasing her about the walnut addiction. Somehow Aidan latched onto the association between his nana and the walnuts. Hearing the familiar name hit me in the gut with a bomb of emotion. It erupted through me, fireworks extending to my fingers and toes. That was what I used to have. That was my perfect happy time. Aidan followed us silently as we made our way back through the hospital to the car park. His footsteps were quiet, though he still moved with a stiff gait. The jeans and jumper I'd bought for him were for a much younger child, yet they still hung loosely on his hips. Dr. Schaefer had told me to cook plenty of protein-rich foods like chicken and fish to help build up his muscles. I longed to take his hand, but I refrained. aware of how much he disliked being touched. Instead, I matched his stride, stepping along with him, and facing the rest of the hospital with him as we walked out of the building together. All eyes were on him. Every nurse stopped what they were doing to stare at the boy who had come back from the dead. Every room we passed, the patients and visitors peeked out through the doors. And the closer we got to the front of the hospital, the more a seeping sense of dread worked its way through my system. I glanced at Denise and saw the tension running along her jaw. She felt it too. Word had got out. If the hospital staff and patients knew who Aidan was, that meant gossip of Aidan's strange arrival had started to spread. But how far had it gone? We were only two or three paces out of the glass doors when a wiry man with a hooked nose stepped into our path.
Matthew Gray from the Yorkshire Post, is this Aidan Price?
Marcus stepped forward, shielding Aidan from the intrusive man. Well, Denise whispered to me, don't say anything. Rob and I put our heads down and walked on, guiding Aidan gently away. But the man sidestepped Marcus and approached Aidan directly.
Are you Aidan Price? Get away from him,
I said between my teeth. This time I did take Aidan's hand. I pulled him away from the reporter and hurried to the car with my heart beating hard and my chest tight. This time, it was only one. Next time he wouldn't be so lucky. Chapter 12. PC Denise Ellis put the kettle on as soon as we made it into the house. They'll find out where he lives soon, she warned. They can't come onto the property, but they'll hang around the boundaries with cameras. We'll do what we can to keep them away. It might be time to get a lawyer, and maybe someone in public relations to help. I didn't want to deal with all this. Aidan had only just taken his shoes off. I'd bought him Velcro trainers. I didn't even know if he could tie his own shoelaces. And I didn't want him to feel embarrassed by not knowing how. We were all crowded awkwardly in the kitchen. All I could think about was how PC Ellis had just left the tea bag on the very expensive ash kitchen side and how it might stain, and how PC Hawthorne still had his boots on. Is that really necessary? I asked. My hands were at it again, one rubbing over the other. Won't it be expensive? Denise stirred milk into the tea. Yes, but you can potentially make quite a lot of money, you know. There are newspaper interviews, TV interviews, a lot. They pay well and you get to tell your story. The stirring stopped and she looked up at me. But don't speak to anyone until the investigation's over. When we put the kidnapper behind bars, that's when you can start talking to the press. No one is telling this story except Aidan. I know, but the press are going to hound you. What we can do, if you want, is release a statement asking for privacy at this difficult time. Never works, but then if they cross the line, you've warned them not to. She handed me a hot cup of tea, and I blew on the liquid to cool it. They'd better leave Aidan alone, Rob said. They have to, don't they? He's a minor, he's just a kid. The problem is, Marcus said, they already know who Aidan is. We would usually keep his name out of the papers, but it was reported on during the flood. Everyone knows Aidan's name. My heart sank. More than anything, I wanted Aidan to have a happy, normal home after everything he'd been through. But he was already famous and he didn't even know it. We're here to help you deal with everything. Denise tried to smile reassuringly, but neither Rob nor I returned the smile. The tea cooled on the table as we took Aidan around his new home. He followed us placidly with small, stiff steps. I found myself rambling as I walked through the house, desperately trying to fill the silence. Jake chose those carpets. He loves white and cream. He's lovely. You'll get to know him soon. I thought you might want to get used to the place first, though. Jake will be home soon, and then you can get to know each other. He's out buying food for us and running errands. We'll have a stocked-up house for you soon. Proper home. Is anyone allowed to spill anything in this house? Rob asked, with an eyebrow raised, his eyes roaming across the luxurious cream throws placed over the sofas. I chose to ignore him. And that is one of my paintings. It was Jake's idea to hang it on the wall. I gestured to the large abstract acrylic hanging on the corridor wall. I painted it shortly after the flood. It represented a great deal of pain for me, with the reds swirled into blues, but Jake had insisted that we display it. He said it was his favourite artwork of all time and I couldn't resist his excited smile. Over time, I grew to look at the painting and see his smile rather than Aidan's coat in the water. Perhaps now that Aidan was back, I'd find something else to see in those swirls of colour.
Squidem, Rob said.
I'd never shown him the painting before, not even in the aftermath of the flood. I'd always kept it to myself. It was only when Jake found me with a knife in one hand and red coating my arms, sat on the floor next to a pile of torn canvases, that I had finally shown someone.
Anyway, up here on the left is the downstairs loo.
I angled my face away from Rob to hide the way my cheeks had flushed.
Downstairs loo, you say? Very la-di-da.
I rolled my eyes at Rob. It wasn't as if his parents didn't have a nice place. He was being an inverted snob. It was cute when we'd been teenagers. I had liked that rebellious streak in him, and the way he railed against his middle-class upbringing. But now it just seemed immature.
Not that there's anything wrong with that,
Rob added hastily, sensing my annoyance.
And up the stairs, this is where your bedroom is, and where my bedroom with Jake is. There's a bathroom there too, with a bath and a shower.
I took a couple of steps up the stairs and glanced back to realise that Aidan wasn't following.
It's okay. Take your time.
I shared a look with Rob. Concern laid low in my belly along with a mouthful of the tea Denise had made me.
I'd never thought of this. I knew that Aidan walked with a stiff gait and that he hadn't had much opportunity to move around over the decade of captivity. But I'd not even thought of the fact he might not have walked upstairs for years and years. It was one of those moments where the extent of Aidan's trauma hit me with full force. This was what he'd been through. This was what he had been forced to endure. This. Not even able to walk upstairs.
Any other 16-year-old would be able to run up them, taking two at a time.
I saw them running up and down the stairs at school all the time. I usually chastised them for it and received a sorry, miss, in return.
Aidan stood there with his gaze fixed on the bottom step. I walked down to meet him and hesitantly placed my hand on his arm.
Okay, so one big step, and then another.
Gently I coaxed him up the first few steps. There were beads of sweat forming on his forehead. His brow was furrowed in concentration, but after the first few steps, he got the hang of it, and I let go of his arm. Rob met us at the top with his arms folded and his mouth in a tight line. I knew what he was thinking. He was thinking about the things he'd do to the man who'd taken our son.
This way, Aidan.
I was getting sick of the sound of my own voice. It was obvious that underneath the bright, cheery tone were the cracks of my own distress. I sounded sickly and weak, desperately trying not to burst into tears at any moment. Part of me wished that Aidan was still in the hospital, just so I didn't have to see his haunted expression in our home. It was worse here, somehow. Hospitals are full of sad or blank faces, but a home should be happy. Aside from the odd row, it should be filled with smiling faces and laughter, not the eerie quiet of the traumatised.
This is your room. I hope you like it. Put some clothes inside the drawers, look, and the wardrobe. There are jeans in here and underwear here. There are towels in the cabinet in the hall outside. And look, I know it's silly, but here's walnut.
I lifted the dragon out from the covers and held it aloft as if it were some sort of precious artifact. Aidan just stared.
Come on, mate, you remember walnut, Rob said. You used to sleep with him every night. Dad used to call him Wally sometimes, and Grandad used to call him...
I trailed off, remembering that I still hadn't told Aidan his grandparents had died. Before I could say any more, Aidan took a step forward and took the dragon from my hand in a swift motion that seemed jarring after his stillness. He stared down at the dragon and my breath caught in my throat. Would this be the moment he broke his silence? I watched him turn the dragon over in his hands, waiting for something, anything. A squeak would suffice. A scream, one word, one letter, anything to indicate that my Aidan was still in there somewhere, alive and kicking and waiting to tell his mummy all the bad things that had happened to him. But he lifted his head and looked at me with the same blank expression on his face. His chestnut eyes were exactly the same as before, without any trace of emotion.
Okay, well, I'll show you my room next,
I said. And this time, my voice really did crack. When my voice grew tired of filling the silences and Rob ran out of things to say, we put the television on in the living room and left Aidan watching a children's channel. I made him a cup of milky tea along with toast and Nutella, left him sitting on the sofa gazing at the colourful pictures on the screen. It was in the kitchen that I let myself go. I let the tears come, and I cried into Rob's T-shirt until I couldn't cry anymore. He made me a peppermint tea and sat me down on the bench next to the table. Denise hovered awkwardly around, mopping up spilled tea, washing the few plates we'd used since we'd been home. Marcus spent most of the time checking his phone or leaning awkwardly against a chair. After Rob glared at them both for a while, Denise excused herself from the kitchen and grabbed Marcus on the way out. What the fuck am I going to do? I ran a hand over my stomach and thought about my pregnancy with Aiden. It was hell. I threw up, I had back pain, I had a terrible labour. I never expected to bond with Aiden, but as soon as the midwife placed him in my arms, I realised I'd never known love until that moment. Pain and the sickness melted away. It had been someone else throwing up in a bin near the school hall, someone else who had been in labour for almost 20 hours. That had never happened. My beautiful little baby just arrived and was plopped into my arms. And that was that for the rest of my life. It just needs time. Rob sipped his tea and grimaced. What is this shit? Badly steeped herbal tea. How long did you leave the bag in for? I don't know, Em, you've changed. Cream carpets, herbal tea, that's not you. Remember how we celebrated Aiden's birth? Half a bottle of vodka on the bench outside Rough Valley, I remember. I had to sit on a cushion because my stitches still hurt. We sat there with Aiden in a sling until it got cold and ate mints before taking him back to my parents. It was a good job I expressed milk before we drank the vodka. But Jesus, Rob, do you think that was good? We were messed up kids. Imagine if we were still sitting around drinking vodka now. Aiden needs stability. Yeah, I know. Rob tapped on the ceramic mug and stared down at his tea. Just how much you've changed, you... I don't know. What? Does this really make you happy? Rob waved his arm around the kitchen at the neat shelves and the pristine finish on the cupboard doors. Where's the character? Where's your influence? This is all him. There's that one painting of yours, which, by the way, is the only bit of colour in this place, and everything else is just... sterile. I hated the truth in his words, and I hated him at that moment. I stood up, took his mug, and emptied it into the sink. He wasn't going to drink it anyway. You better go. Don't forget to rinse that mug. The chair scraped as he moved away from the table. He snatched up his jacket from the back of the chair and began to yank it on over his arms. You won't want to leave any tea stains on the perfect cream surface. And for fuck's sake, don't spill any on your grey dresses in your beige house. I'll go and say goodbye to Aiden. I put the mug down in the sink and sighed. Don't leave. He paused. The jacket came off. And almost immediately his arms were wrapped around my waist, stretching across my back with a baby bump between us. His head leaned against my shoulder. I've missed you, Emma. No, that's not what I meant. I pulled away, removing his hands. No, we need to figure out what we're going to do. I ducked around him and avoided his eyes. I felt my cheeks. Felt the flushed warmth of embarrassment. I mean, we need to figure out a plan for how we're going to deal with the press and how we're going to cope with Aiden until he's better. I finally lifted my head and found his gaze. I'm carrying Jake's child, Rob. I can't do this. Chapter 13. It might surprise you to know that before Aiden was taken during the flood, I never considered myself a bad mother. Not even when I was 18 years old with a baby at my breast did I worry about whether I was a good or bad mother. I went with it. I nurtured when I wanted to nurture. I was fun when I needed to be. I was creative when I was in the mood. There were times when Aiden was crying or throwing a tantrum that I needed a deep breath and longed for more of the vodka I drank with Rob on the bench outside Rough Valley Forest. But they were rare and I didn't dwell on them. I was never the kind of mum who bought every gadget and newfangled toy as soon as it came out to appease her little darlings. I was never the overcompensator because I felt guilty about snapping at my precious one or losing my temper after one too many glasses of Chardonnay. Not that I want to judge those people. We're all getting by in this life. I won't begrudge people their own methods for coping, but that just wasn't me. Despite my age, or maybe because of it, I always felt secure about my parenting, and Mum always helped in her own laid-back style. But now... well, now I was the opposite. I was an indulger. As part of Aidan's recovery program, I was required to make him meals from Dr. Schaefer's list of suggestions, which I intended to. But I also wanted to make up for everything he'd been through. I wanted to prove to him that there were still good things in the world. I'd already racked my brain for Aidan's favourite recipes. He'd been a boy with a sweet tooth, and I had allowed him a few treats every now and then. But now I poured the treats into his hands, Mars bars and Snickers and Kinder Eggs with Star Wars toys inside. I stocked up on all kinds of goodies. I made him hot chocolate and buttery toast. When Jake came home that Sunday evening, I made a hot dog casserole with thick pieces of white bread on the side and some chips, because I remembered how much he loved chips. And all the time I made this food, I had a ridiculous smile on my face, occasionally catching a glimpse of myself in the shining microwave door and wondering if I'd become possessed by the Joker from the Batman films. I found myself filled with electric nervous energy that spilled out as I moved around the kitchen. Even washing my hands was a frantic scrubbing rather than my usual quick rinse and dry. "Now, Aidan, I want you to know that this is your home and you're welcome here," Jake said as I busied around the two men in my life, trying not to think about the moment Rob had wrapped his arms around me in this very spot. "But there are rules." I turned and watched. Aidan appeared to be listening intently. I had been about to tell Jake to go easy, but he certainly had Aidan's attention. And even though I didn't particularly agree with giving Aidan ground rules so soon, it was good to see my son actually listening. So I let him continue. "We keep a tidy house here. We wash our dishes straight after using them and we put things away. But don't worry too much, okay? Don't get stressed out about it. We'll help you out, okay, kid?" I couldn't help but smile. Jake really was trying his best to deal with the situation. As I stirred my casserole, Jake directed Aidan in setting the kitchen table. They unfolded a tablecloth together and put down the placemats. My damaged old heart fleshed out just a little bit as I watched them. If only Aidan had smiled or said something. Perhaps listening would have to do for now. The way Aidan quietly followed Jake's instructions felt like progress, and I loved Jake all the more for the way he was handling my psychologically wounded son. "All right, who's ready for hot dogs?" I asked. Jake stuck his hand up like the suck-up kid in class. "I certainly am. What about you, Aidan?" "I hope you're both hungry," I said, trying to fill the silence while Aidan ignored the question. As I placed the hot dish onto the table, the phone began to ring. "I'll get it." Jake started to stand, but I flapped my hands at him and shook my head. "I'm on my feet anyway. You two get your teas while it's still hot." I padded into the hall to pick up the landline. There were only a handful of people who bothered to call the landline, which could explain why my heart was pattering beneath my grey woolen jumper. I shook my head, trying to ignore the irrational heat of anxiety worming its way through my veins. "Hello? Emma, it's DCI Stevenson. Are you well?" "I'm fine. Is everything all right?" "Everything's fine, Emma, but I wanted to talk to you about an idea I have." The next morning, I stood on the edge of Rough Valley Forest with Aidan on my right and Dr. Foster and DCI Stevenson to my left. We'd always called it going rough when we were teenagers. We'd drink in rough as a dare. To me, the forest had always been a place of silliness, of youth and irresponsibility. That day, standing next to Aidan, could not be more different than going rough. I had an important job to do as a mother. I'd agreed with DCI Stevenson to keep our intentions quiet. Jake had wanted to come with us, but I'd advised him to go to school instead. The less fuss, the better. I hadn't called Rob, which I was trying not to think about. Would he understand? He'd want to be here, I knew that much, but I didn't want to crowd Aidan. We all had on our waterproof coats against the rain. Aidan's was brand new, bought only a few days ago, but I hadn't thought to buy wellies, so trainers had to suffice. It was a grey, drab day. A nothing day. A day that should barely be a blip on our own personal radars. And yet, it was a something day, because of what was about to happen. There was also a hint of beauty in the low-hanging fog. The rain pattered against the hood of my jacket. The air was very still, without even a hint of wind, which brought the rain directly overhead. Mist clung to the branches and blocked the path to the forest.
"I would have waited," said Stevenson. "But with the story beginning to spread, I thought it would be best to try now, before the press start following us around wherever we go. How's Aidan doing?"
It was a loaded question, and we both knew it. DCI Stevenson was, of course, desperate for Aidan to start talking. We all were. "Small steps," I said. Then I added, "Still no words."
"It's going to take time, Detective," said Dr. Foster. I was glad of her presence, though she had remained relatively quiet so far. It was nice to have another woman around sometimes, especially if she backed you up from time to time.
Stevenson nodded, his thin lips even thinner than normal. The disappointment was easy to read on his face.
"You know what I'd like Aidan to do today, don't you?"
I took in the sight of the team he had gathered. There were only two other officers present. He wanted to keep the team small so as not to spook Aidan. They were here to collect any evidence they found. I clenched and unclenched my hands, trying not to rub them any more. There was a sore rash spreading over my hands, and the constant rubbing was doing them no good.
"I understand. I think it's too soon, though."
My gut told me that. If Aidan wasn't ready to speak to us, I doubted he was ready to show us either, though I'd continued to let him have his pens and paper in case he decided to. So far, he'd drawn nothing but scribbles.
"We need to try," DCI Stevenson said. "But take your time."
I glanced from the trees to the narrow road on my left. We were deliberately close to the spot where the driver had seen Aidan staggering away from the woods. This was where they had picked him up and taken him to the police station. What if it was them, I thought, and then dismissed it. Of course the police would have checked that avenue already. Besides, why would Aidan's kidnapper take Aidan to the police station? I berated myself for my own stupidity. I wouldn't be much help on this case if I didn't think logically. I turned to Aidan, who was as still as always, staring into the foggy woods. There was no indication that he even recognised his surroundings. Certainly no indication that he had suffered some sort of psychological breakdown after a traumatic event. It had happened right here, in this spot. Unless he wasn't speaking before. The doctors had taken an MRI scan of his brain to check for brain damage. There was none. Aside from not speaking, he understood us. He walked, put his clothes on, brushed his teeth, all with perfect coordination. There was no evidence to suggest that he had learning difficulties, though the doctor did tell us that autism was a possibility. In my heart, I knew it wasn't autism. At 6 years old, before he was taken from me, Aidan hadn't shown any indication of autism. This mutism had been triggered through the years of trauma. Years. How could I ever get used to thinking that? Years of systematic abuse. How was he even still a person? I wiped a sheen of sweat from my brow and pulled myself together. "Are you ready?" I asked. Aidan had his hood pulled down so I couldn't see his eyes. The sleeves of his jacket were too long, covering his hands, but I had the impression that Aidan was clenching his fists inside the coat. He was even straighter than usual. Perhaps I was wrong. Perhaps he was reacting to the woods more than I had thought. "Aidan? Can you show us where you came from? Do you remember the night you came out of the woods? You were walking down this road. It was raining then too, but it was night time and it was dark. You didn't have a coat on like you do now. You just wore jeans and nothing else." DCI Stevenson had told me to try and evoke Aidan's sense of memory by mentioning as much detail as I could. "You came out of the woods from this direction." I turned my body and indicated with my hand. "And then you walked down the road, except you were struggling to walk. I don't think you'd walked that far for a long time." I stopped to catch my breath.
"You're doing really well, Emma. Keep going." Dr. Foster gave me an encouraging nod.
I took a deep breath. DCI Stevenson watched carefully with his hands tucked inside his pocket. Even though he went to great measures to keep his expression neutral, I saw the tension in his body and knew how much it would mean to him for this to work. I longed for it to work too, but I had my doubts.
Maybe if I walk into the woods a bit, would you come with me just to take a walk?
I suggested. When Aidan inevitably didn't reply, I took a few tentative steps. He didn't. I reached out for him.
Come for a walk with Mummy.
There was a desperate tremor in my voice. I blinked, forcing back the emotion threatening to erupt.
It would make me really happy if you came for a walk with me. I really want to know Aidan. I want to know what happened and where you came from. Will you show me?
He moved with his left foot first, and my heart swelled. Then another step. His movements were stiffer than ever, like a robot taking his first steps. Then another step. I nodded him forward, smiling so hard I felt the skin crack in the corners of my mouth. My cheeks ached. Another. But there was something wrong. He was breathing heavily.
Is it okay?
I coaxed.
I'm here, and nothing is going to happen to you. You're safe. I promise.
Look, DCI Stevenson will make sure of that. He's like a bodyguard. He's strong, like Superman. I avoided Stevenson's eyes, worried he might laugh or more likely grimace.
It's okay, Aidan.
The rain continued to patter down, picking up speed, almost drowning out the sound of my voice. I moved forward a few more steps, walking between the first line of trees into the woods. It was a large forest, almost as big as a national park, but never given the status. There was rumour of private land bought within the woods, and some was owned by a stately house that resided on a hill overlooking the village. I'd often gone wandering through those woods with Rob, taking our vodka and our cigarettes and worse into the depths. Though it was cold and dark, being there with Rob had always evoked a sense of ticklish danger that warmed my extremities. But now it was different. I saw nothing but pain lurking within those trees. The pain experienced by my son and the pain I'd felt when he was taken from me. My coaxing seemed to work. Aidan shuffled forward, finally reaching me. I took his small hand and found that it was like a block of ice. I rubbed it between my palms, injecting heat into those cold fingers. Aidan was deathly pale. Two bruised eyes looking out at me from beneath the hood, which should have been enough to make me turn back. I didn't.
Everything's going to be all right, I said.
I wanted this to work. I wanted it more than anything. I wanted to find Aidan's kidnapper and get justice, not just for Aidan, but for me too. How could I sleep at night knowing he was still out there? So I pulled Aidan on. He resisted. He pulled back. I was firm. I stepped on into the woods, holding Aidan's hand, determined that he would show us what he knew. It was in there, deep down. Everything we needed was in there, locked up tight. I just needed the key, and I thought it lay within the leaning beech trees of Rough. Come on, I said, my tone frostier than before, frustration creeping in. But Aidan was resisting. He refused to move any further, digging his heels into the soft, muddy ground. Please, Aidan, I insisted. If he did this one thing, he could solve everything. I was close to tears as I thought of the monster still out there, still lurking somewhere ready to take my son for a second time. I couldn't allow that to happen. The answers were inside Aidan. I knew they were, but he refused to tell me. I was reduced to begging him. Aidan! I brushed away a tear, aware of everyone watching us, embarrassed, frustrated, and close to the breaking point. Maybe we should take a break there, Emma, said Dr. Foster. This time I wasn't interested in hearing her opinion. She was supposed to be backing me up, wasn't she? Sisterhood and all that.
No!
I didn't recognize my own voice. It was more like a growl. There was a hint of a wild animal in there, and still I gripped Aidan's arm while he squirmed away from me, no longer silent but panting heavily.
Aidan, you will show us! You will show us!
DCI Stevenson held up his hands. This was a mistake. You're right, Emma. He's not ready. Let him go.
No!
My lips trembled. My voice was virtually unrecognizable. I didn't know who I was anymore. My face was wet, but whether it was from the rain or from my tears, I didn't know.
Aidan, please!
Emma, let the boy go.
No!
Emma, look at his face. Dr. Foster was firmer this time. Look at the distress you're causing him. I blinked, bringing the world back into focus. Aiden. Where was my Aiden? I shook my head and tried to concentrate. There he was, all grown up, a different boy than when he left. He was red-faced with wide eyes, shaking his head back and forth, leaning away from me with his heels dug firmly in the ground. Aiden. I let him go, and my knees buckled. Chapter 14. I'd messed it up. I'd ruined a good shot at finding out more about what Aiden was keeping locked up inside him, and probably ruined any trust we'd built together. Even after sitting in the police car with a steaming cup of tea, waiting for the rain to stop, Aiden was terrified of the woods. He was wary of me, too, now. He flinched when I tried to hold his hand. He backed away when I walked towards him, and he turned his head away from me when I tried to talk to him. I'd made everything 100 times worse than before. I felt like the lowest of the low. I was a slight step up from the deranged monster who took him. I was pond scum. Nasty, grimy. I wanted to go home and take a shower to scrub the filth from my body. What kind of person behaves like that with their traumatized child? Here. Dr. Foster handed me the plastic cup from a thermos flask filled with milky coffee. Don't dwell on today. We'll talk about it in the therapy session on Thursday, okay? I wrapped my hands around the cup, desperate for its much-needed warmth, and nodded. There was nothing more to say. She couldn't reassure me or placate me. There was nothing anyone could say. I'd been in the wrong. I behaved in an aggressive manner towards my own son. I thought about the way I tried to drag him, like a farmer with a reluctant bull, and cringed into my boots. DCI Stevenson rested next to me on the side of the police car. Aiden was in the front seat, sitting quietly. I shouldn't have pushed for this, I'm sorry. We had to try. It was me that fucked it all up. Stevenson shook his head. I don't think he would have gone in there anyway. He's just not ready. Get the two of you home, rest up. Bond. We'll try this another day. What's going to happen next? Are you still searching the forest? He scratched the side of his jaw. The bags around his eyes had deepened, revealing the toll this stressful case was having on his psyche. As much as we can. Plots of land have been sold off, and it's proving to be difficult approaching the companies they belong to. We'll need warrants to search them. We're checking out any planning permission from 10 years ago that might relate to some sort of small room built in the area. There's a chance that Aiden had been walking for a long time before he was found. We can't be 100% sure that he's been kept in the forest all this time. Okay. You'll keep me updated, won't you? I'll be in touch, he said. But my priority's on the case now. Denise or Marcus will be with you from now on, and they'll liaise between you and the police. It made sense. DCI Stevenson's time was best spent working on the case, but part of me had come to rely on his reassuring calmness and would miss his familiar presence. Get Aiden home and in the warmth, he said, his voice low and soothing. I'll be in contact as soon as I know anything. He was right. More than anything, I needed to pick myself up. The stress of the last few days had culminated in this complete loss of control, and that couldn't happen again. Stay strong for Aiden, I thought. It would be my mantra. I was a mother first, and a mother could always be strong for her children. Surely. Aiden removed his jacket and pulled the seatbelt across his chest without needing to be prompted when we got into the car. I didn't try to fill the silence with my own jabbering. I put the radio on to chase the silence away. Eventually, the colour returned to Aiden's cheeks. He lost the wide-eyed, glassy look, and he seemed to relax. Until we turned into our street. Fuck! I hadn't had time to watch the news or read the papers that morning. If I had, I would have seen the front-page story about the little boy who had come wandering out of the woods 10 years after he was thought to have died in the worst flood for 100 years. I missed it all. My phone had been on silent all morning, and I hadn't thought to check it as we left Rough Valley. The reporters were lying in wait to ambush us. Their vans lined the street. There was a television reporter and a cameraman talking to one of my neighbours. Shit. I backed out of the road before they saw me and drove in the opposite direction. Why didn't you tell me? Josie stood in the door with her jaw hanging open, eyes darting from me to Aiden and back to me. Oh, it's been a whirlwind, Joe. Can we come in? Yes, sure. She backed away, letting us in through the enormous wooden doorway. Her eyes never moved from Aiden. He's so like Rob. She shut the door behind us, still staring at Aiden. It was only when I cleared my throat that she awoke from her trance. I'll put the kettle on. Josie led the way through the large modern entrance hall to the even larger, more modern kitchen. Jake was a huge fan of this kitchen. In fact, he had quizzed Hugh, Josie's husband, about kitchen contractors for hours. He was a big admirer of the clean white lines and the soft closed drawers. There was even a revolving wine rack that lit up with little blue LED lights. Hugh's in London on a business trip, so it's just the two of us. I'm sure he'll call today. It's all over the news. He'll be so happy to see Aiden. Josie bustled around the kitchen, flicking on the kettle, pulling white porcelain mugs out of the cupboards. I just can't believe it, after all these years. I sat on a stool by the breakfast bar and Aiden stood awkwardly away from me. When I pulled one of the stools towards him, he continued to stand, which I pretended didn't feel like a stab to the gut. I had amends to make. It's all really complicated, I said. It's, there's a lot. I took a breath. Josie leaned over the counter. Hey, it's going to be okay. I shook my head. It wasn't, but I couldn't say that while Aiden was stood right with us. Aiden, would you like a tea? When you were little, you used to come and stay with us, do you remember? You liked milky tea and strawberry jam on toast. Aiden just blinked. He's not talking right now, I said. But keep talking to him. I think it helps. We've just come from Rough Valley. I've messed up, Joe. Josie sensed the mood, so she walked around the breakfast bar. Aiden, I think I have a DVD of The Jungle Book. I know you're all grown up now, but you loved that film when you stayed with us. Remember? You'd sit with Uncle Hugh on the sofa and watch it together. Shall I put it on for you? He'll follow you, I said. He won't respond, but he likes watching TV, so that could help. When Josie came back, she poured boiling water over the tea bags. What's happened, Em? I traced the pattern of the marble with my finger. He was kidnapped. Someone took my child, chained him up in a dungeon or something awful, and they did stuff. I couldn't say it. Joe's arms wrapped around my shoulders, holding me tight. When she sniffed loudly, I could tell she was crying too. I can't believe it. She pulled away, dabbed her eyes with a tissue, and distributed the tea made strong and brown. Builder's tea. There were reporters outside my home waiting for me, filming my house. I have 50 missed calls, most of them from numbers I don't recognize. I haven't called Jake back, or Rob, or Sonia. They're all expecting me to know what to do. Aiden needs me to know what to do, and I just lost it. When, honey? I sniffed and tried to compose myself. Snivelling wasn't going to help anyone. No more than an hour ago. The police wanted to see if Aiden would walk through the woods and retrace his steps back to wherever he was kept, but I'd lost it. I tried to drag him into the woods, Joe. I physically grabbed him and tried to force him to do something he didn't want to do. I'm as bad as the monster who took him. No, you're not. Josie handed me a box of tissues and I wiped my eyes. Don't ever think that. Whoever did those things to him is a monster. They're barely even human. Their brain is wired all wrong. Em, it's not the same thing at all. Halfway through The Jungle Book, we stumbled out of the kitchen and into the living room where we watched Aiden watching the film. Josie nodded for me to sit down. Rather than sit right next to Aiden, I chose a spot in a comfy armchair just next to the sofa. Josie pulled a beanbag chair closer and sat next to me. With her help, I called Jake, Rob, and Sonia and talked through the situation with the reporters with them. I listened to voicemails from DCI Stevenson warning me that the story was out, several reporters, a woman from a PR company, and Denise, our family liaison officer. The second cup of tea finally warmed up the chill I'd gained from standing out in the cold. I felt calmer. How's the baby? Josie asked. I stroked my pregnant belly. She's a wriggler. She'll play for Arsenal as soon as she comes out. Josie laughed, and when I joined in, it felt good. How are things with you? Josie tucked her legs underneath her body and wrapped her hands around her mug. It was a small, insignificant movement, but it seemed to me that she was stalling answering the question. Things are pretty much the same. Josie and Hugh had been experiencing some marital problems over the last few years. While they'd been the epitome of a happy couple back when they first married 17 years ago, that relationship had gradually disintegrated. Josie was a little older than me. She married Hugh straight out of university in a fancy church ceremony. Hugh wasn't from Bishoptown, but they decided to move here to start a family. Hugh's family had been wealthy for generations. Josie's family had made money running a successful chain of furniture shops. But Josie had been unable to conceive, and their large country pad echoed from emptiness. Hugh fell into a pattern of leaving Josie alone for long periods of time, while he went to conferences and business trips in London, working in his brother's corporate investment business. Except that every time he goes on a business trip, he contacts me less and less. He used to ring me twice a day, then it was once. Now I'm lucky if I hear from him after 2 or 3 days. He doesn't even bother to call me when he arrives safely. Do you call him? I used to, but these days I don't even feel the need to do that. It's like I've stopped caring. Joe. I know, it's awful. She curled up on her beanbag, hugging her body tightly. I sighed. I hate to think of you all alone in this house, not even talking to Hugh on the phone. You need to pick up the phone and call Joe. At least call me so I can come over and keep you company. She lightly waved her hand to simulate a breezy denial, but I could tell how hard she was trying not to cry. You've got the baby, and now you have all this with Aiden? My crap doesn't even compare. Of course it does. Don't ever say that. Josie had been through things she didn't talk about, not even to me. Perhaps that's why I thought of her first. I could have taken Aiden to Rob's. He was Aiden's father, after all. Perhaps I just didn't feel like dealing with Rob's mother. Either way, it was Josie's door I turned up at, and it was Josie who I felt had the strongest affinity with Aiden and what he had been through. Though Josie had never really opened up to me, I knew there was something dark lurking beneath her tight smile. I'd always known. She dropped little hints over the years. Nothing particularly concrete, but I had a feeling she might understand more about how Aiden was feeling than anyone else I knew. Chapter 15. On the way to the bathroom, I found myself wandering around the Barrett house, refreshing my memories of a happier time. Josie and I went to school together, but she was a few years older than me, and we never really hung out. But one day, when I was struggling with Aiden in a Bishoptown cafe, Josie came to my rescue, standing up for me against a busybody old lady who had told me to shut that thing up. Aiden was 4 and had dropped his ice cream on the floor. Josie swooped in with a second bowl of ice cream to give to Aiden and plonked herself on the chair next to me. We were friends from that first moment. She even helped me snag a part-time job at the accountancy firm where she worked on the outskirts of Bishoptown. I hadn't needed the money, but I had needed a life outside Aiden, and the job gave me a new sense of purpose. I had always thrived on being a mother, but it didn't satisfy me in the way a career did. I needed that extra direction in my life in order to find my own brand of happiness. Though being a mother had always been wonderful to me, having a job fulfilled me in a different way. Josie and Hugh welcomed us into their house with open arms. Looking back, I think they may have been a little desperate. At that point, they'd been trying for a baby for around a year and nothing was happening. Their house suddenly seemed empty and they needed to fill it with people. I'd always thought that Aiden was both a reminder and a distraction at that difficult time. I walked through the corridors, remembering the time Rob, Aiden, and I all squished into one of the spare rooms. There were plenty to choose from, but we'd all decided to sleep in the same bed. After Aiden's disappearance, both Josie and Hugh were huge helps, delivering food to the house, offering shoulders to cry on. Hugh even paid for contractors to search the river after the search and rescue team had given up. They were my best friends. My only real friends. I stopped and stared out at Wetherington House,